Am I afraid that the robot's going to replace me? And I'm thinking, not hardly, because the day you figure out how to get a robot to replace what I do in the operating room, that means I will have a ridiculously cool job doing something higher within healthcare that the robot can't do.
From Stanford University and SiriusXM, it's the future of everything. I'm Russ Altman, and today, Professor Carla Pugh will tell us how she uses technology to watch surgeons in action. She wants to understand what makes a surgeon skilled and how can young surgeons more efficiently gain those skills. It's the future of surgery. Among the complex cognitive and physical tasks that humans can perform, you have to put surgery right near the top. Surgeons literally open our bodies, assess the anatomy, and figure out how to manipulate all of those tissues to either repair damaged ones or take out the ones that are diseased. Of course, surgeons enter surgery with a plan for how they will proceed. They've taken x-rays, MRIs, CTs. They kind of know what to expect, but once they open us up, they don't really know what they might find. So they have to be nimble and flexible. They must make sure they don't cut stuff that shouldn't be cut, that they don't cause an infection, that they quickly and efficiently do the task, and then close the patient up so they can begin their recovery. Skilled and experienced surgeons, they're efficient, they're fast, and they minimize errors. They are physically precise in their motions and make decisions about how to proceed on the fly as they do the work. But it is easy to say efficient and fast. What does it really mean? How can we formalize our understanding of these special surgical skills so that we can evaluate the progress of young surgeons as they get better and how we can monitor surgeons once they're at their peak to make sure their skills don't fall? Professor Carla Pugh is a professor of surgery and an acute care surgeon at Stanford University. She runs the technology-enabled Clinical Improvement Center, which studies physician performance, focusing particularly on surgeons and how they do surgeries. She focuses also on the education of young surgeons and ways to track their progress from inexperienced to ready for prime time. In fact, Carla was the first surgeon in the United States to get a PhD in education. Carla, you run a center called the Technology-Enabled Clinical Improvement Center. Tell me about what's the mission of the center and what do you do?
Really what we are doing specifically are using sensor technology, whether it's force sensing resistors, motion trackers, MEMS, we've explored the gamut. And the common theme in terms of our goal, our long-term goal, has been to use that technology to quantify what it is that physicians who are at the top of their game do, either when they're doing a basic physical exam on a patient or doing a complex operation in the OR. That's what we want to do. We want to quantify expertise, and having that benchmark will help us shorten the learning curve to competency for the trainees and get into a little bit of Olympian kind of competition with those who, you know, are self-proclaimed experts. Okay. What is it that you do? I want to see it.
So when people think about wearables, they're normally thinking about like putting on an Apple Watch and going out into the world. But when you're talking about wearables and sensors, and I know you're a surgeon, and I know a lot of your work, not all of it, but a lot of it has been with other surgeons. You're putting all kinds of devices on them and around them, and you're literally tracking how they move, how fast they move, kind of the size of their motions. Are they small little motions or big motions, the speed? So the first question is, how do surgeons react to being so highly watched and instrumented during these very sensitive procedures? Because I presume, are you doing this on real patients or are they doing simulated surgeries when you study them?
Right now, we're doing simulated surgeries.
Okay.
I have actually worn one of the wearables myself in the OR. I am not just a surgeon scientist, but I am a guinea pig. So I am a prescriber, subscriber of all of this. So the ones that I've been able to wear in the OR are the ones that don't require sterilization. So EEG on the forehead. Yes, you can see my brain when I'm trying to teach a resident an operation. Yes, I've worn them.
Okay, and how did that make you feel? Were you ultra self-conscious about what you were doing, or were you able to forget it and just be the excellent surgeon that you are?
I completely forgot that I was wearing it, Russ. I can tell you, the early adopters of this technology, come on, we're surgeons. We all think we're the best. We think if you're going to have a database, our data should be in it, because everyone to be lucky enough to try and be like me in the operating room. Yes, seriously. Okay.
Yes.
The surgeons want the data. They just don't want it to be used against them.
Right. So tell me, what are some of the basic learnings that you've had? And when you're watching these extremely skilled people do their craft, for example, what is the difference between a very skilled practitioner and somebody who's still learning? What do the sensors tell you?
We do a sensor suite. We're looking at eye tracking. We're looking at brain waves. We're looking at when they're talking, and when they talk, what do they say? We're looking at when they're moving, and more importantly, with the motion tracking, we get to see when they're not moving.
Right.
And it turns out that the full choreography, moving, not moving, tells a real important story. The difference between someone who's Olympian at the top of their game and someone who is sort of beginning early level surgeon is really where they pause and how long they pause. Huh.
Can you tell me more? That sounds really interesting.
It represents surgical planning. It represents when you're not moving your hands. We've tracked it back to that's the point in time when you're looking at critical anatomy. The master surgeons have seen that critical anatomy 10 times. They're quick to say, okay, good. It's this, that, and that. Now I can pull these three things together, and they're ready to go. The novice surgeon is studying thinking a little longer. So it's idle time.
Yep.
And where it occurs. So we know which procedure steps separate the silver medalist from the gold medalist.
So that's fabulous. And I know you've even written a paper about analyzing the what you called the idle time during surgery. And I guess this is related to those insights, is that when they're stopping, you can kind of figure out exactly why they're stopping and whether it's a red flag stop, like, holy cow, I'm in trouble, or if it's a, okay, I'm doing some mileposting to figure out what my next steps are, but there's no sense of panic.
The idle time metric has been absolutely amazing. And what you see is as you ascend along the learning curve from competency to mastery, where you are idle within the exact same procedure, if I took 100 surgeons from their first year in practice to their 20th year, how long they're idle at the critical points varies and changes over time.
Interesting. I think that you also wrote about surgeons who are at a very excellent level start to look very much the same, maybe more alike than they even realize. I found that really interesting. So could you expand on what was that observation?
We were just fascinated when we saw this, Russ. You know, every surgical procedure has a signature in terms of all the movements. Once you look at the motion profile of an entire procedure, the classic analogy I use is it may have the shape of a butterfly. And the difference between patients may change that from a large butterfly to a small butterfly. But what we realized is that the surgeons, when they talk about how they do the procedure, they're saying, well, I start on the left and I use this instrument, and they're giving all of these details that are personal to them. Another surgeon will like, yeah, I do that procedure, and mine's better than yours because I start on the right and I use this instrument. And they're having this whole instrument conversation. And guess what? The motion and the pattern has nothing. Well, it's a little bit to do with the instrument, very small amount. 90% of that pattern relates to the patient's anatomy.
Right.
And Russ, the aorta has been in the same place for a very long time. So that pattern is created based on the patient's anatomy. And if you're going to take the kidney out, the left kidney, that pattern of navigating that with the renal artery, the renal vein, and how it gets to the cava and the aorta, that is the GPS of human anatomy.
Right.
And that's what we're getting. And the surgeons are navigating that. And they're all talking about all these different, they're talking about what kind of car they drive. They're talking about what music they're listening to. And none of it is super irrelevant in terms of the mastery and the details that you need to understand to shorten the learning curve. So that was our huge epiphany.
That is fascinating. And I did want to ask a little bit more about the difference between the experts and the novices. It seems obvious that the experts would be faster, like the overall procedure time would be shorter. Is that correct?
Overall procedure time is shorter. One of the other amazing things we noticed, in those critical points of the operation, the master surgeons move slower. They have more idle time where it counts. And it goes back to this old adage of do it perfectly the first time.
Of course, that makes sense. They know the danger moments. I know that when I do a drive to work on my bike, I know all the places where I could get killed. And that's when I start paying attention. And then for the rest of the bike ride, I don't have to pay as much attention because it's not a high danger situation. With respect to the novices, I think you've also done analysis of like how rapid their movements are and like the amplitude. Are they big motions or small motions? Are there significant differences there? This is really interesting to me because this is a place where surgeons, and you used the word choreography earlier and when you were speaking, and I love that word because it really does seem like a choreographed. So are the movements short and sweet in the expert surgeons?
Definitely. So we call it working volume because we've got three-dimensional data in terms of their motion. Yes, the working volume for the master surgeons is much smaller. And in fact, we looked at medical students and we were afraid. We're like, there it is. You know, they do in this suture and they pull the suture through and the needle's like out the field and in the table and everyone's covering their eyes. We're like, hey, yeah, no, that's not how you do that. And just the working volume, it's much smaller for the master surgeon and they control it. So one of the things we learned between the novice and the master surgeon is that master surgeon does not mean that you don't make mistakes. What we do notice is that master surgeons have more efficient error rescue, and they do not accept inferior circumstances that they've created for themselves. So you're going along, you're suturing, you do something, and you know your suture is messed up or whatever. The surgeons will cut the suture shorter or fix the scenario in front of them so that they can then continue to be efficient. Novice surgeons deal with it. They're distracted. They still can get to the end game, but cognitive load is much higher when you're not working smart.
I want to get to robots because that's a very exciting area. But before we get there, as you start to actually look at other surgeons instrumented, what are the ethical and issues? You made a mention earlier in our conversation that as long as we don't use the information against them, but I'm going to guess that you're going to measure at some time an elderly surgeon whose game is perhaps not at the point that it was 10 or 20 years before. And so talk to me a little bit about how you set this up so it can be positive and not threatening.
Yeah, no, this is a really, really great point. And I think it's important to pause and note that the measurement culture in healthcare has not really been one that focused on helping surgeons shorten the learning curve. It's been credentialing and then minimum competency. And if you don't pass, then you can't practice your craft. So it's more punitive, high stakes measurement culture. Flip that to baseball or any other sports where they've had all their measurements for years. We all know it. It's all public. It's more competitive and it's more, instead of high stakes, it's what we call formative. You get that feedback. You take it to a coach, you do better, you practice, and then you benchmark yourself against everyone else. That's what I'm shooting for with this. So we have to protect our ability to use the data. I think we want to self-monitor senior surgeons, for example. What I've learned from them, I mean, we've gone public with this, obviously still in a sim environment. No surgeon wants to end their career with a bad case. They're like, I want to have my data longitudinal. Then I'm in control. I start to see my ascent to mastery and then things start trickling off. I can narrow my practice. No one wants to make a mistake at the end of their career. You've had an amazing career. Everyone loves you. People want to go out in a blaze of glory, not shame.
That is a great, it really makes sense. So if you can say, hey, there are certain parts of your surgical skills that look like they're eroding a little bit, there's been no disaster yet. As you said, let's narrow and let's put you in a position where all of your experience can be used maximally, but there may be some types of procedures that are just not what you should be doing now. And that can be done all prospectively. And so patients benefit, and also that the surgeon's career is reasonably, it can be choreographed in a much more reasonable way.
Inspiring, right? Because instead of making that decision, who is the senior surgeon, and you're basing on age, I can tell you there are some 70-year-old surgeons that are still running circles around 50-year-old surgeons who are still, you know, on that learning curve to mastery. So we don't want to push the folks who've learned the most out before they're ready.
We can battle the ageism. We don't want to be ageists.
Based on data-driven decisions.
This is The Future of Everything with Russ Altman. More with Dr. Carla Pugh next on SiriusXM Business Radio Channel 132. Welcome back to The Future of Everything. I'm Russ Altman, and I'm speaking with Professor Carla Pugh of Stanford University. In the last segment, we discussed her work dissecting, no pun intended, the motions of surgeons at work. Now, I will ask her about the use of robots and automation in surgery. Robots are already being used in surgery, but Carla clarifies that humans are not likely to be taken out of the loop anytime soon.
No, I think there's a lot of excitement about robotic surgery, and appropriately so. I think any opportunity to have greater access and greater dexterity in terms of, you know, degrees of freedom to get at complex anatomy, I'm all for it. I think it's amazing. I think what's really, really interesting with the robot on two sides, patient perception is that the robot is doing the surgery. My goodness, that we do not have autonomous robots doing surgery, but you can't tell any of the patients that, and they want the robot surgery, and they don't understand the difference between robotic and laparoscopic and open. They just think that, you know, open procedures are archaic and I need that robot. Okay. Well, the surgeon still operates the robot. The robot is fully controlled by the surgeon.
Right.
It's just that it can do and get in places where the surgeon with their hands can't, so it just, it's interesting. On the other side of that, the far extreme, I've got my engineering colleagues who I love dearly. I have a lab full of engineers, and I, you know, the robot community loves me because I just get out there and I'm like, I have the metrics, I understand this, I know what it takes to train a robotic surgeon, but the constant drive or love is to get to that autonomous robot. And people ask me, am I afraid, you know, that the robot's going to replace me? And I'm thinking, not hardly, because the day you figure out how to get a robot to replace what I do in the operating room, that means I will have a ridiculously cool job doing something higher within healthcare that the robot can't do. So there's this circular thing on both sides.
Now, do you think that the kinds of measurements you're making of human surgeons, will that translate into the same types of behaviors for robots? Let's say they become autonomous or semi-autonomous. Maybe they don't do the whole thing, but you get to a point and as a surgeon you can say, okay, do the closure or open up the belly and clear out the other organs so I can focus on the kidney. Or, you know, some, it's not the whole surgery, but it's a little piece of it. Do you think that they will wind up doing it like humans, or will they explore an entirely different space because they have different strengths and weaknesses from humans?
You know, that's a really, really good question, Russ, because I think in my mind, you know, even 20 years ago when I first started collecting data on human performance, I was convinced that the data that we were collecting as humans interacted with, you know, mannequin trainers, just to understand and digitize the human workflow, that would be important for programming robots.
Right.
Once we get that basic programming, then yes, there are some huge benefits in terms of robots compared to surgeons. Surgeons get fatigued, surgeons discommunication. But in the best case scenario, I see a combined process. There's always going to be human in the loop. And I think if we start to think about that, then we can move forward more quickly. When we think about autonomous robot, think about human in the loop, and what do we want the robot to do?
Yes.
To tell you the parts of the surgery based on the data we're collecting. When the surgeon is moving really quickly, that's the easiest part of the operation. So if you take that motion profile and that map and print it according to velocity, you know what the robot during the moments was idle, because that's when you're gathering all these information. And
yeah, your data will tell the robot companies or the robot people, you should focus on this first, because I can tell you that all the surgeons are fast, and therefore this is, none of it is easy, but this is the most straightforward part of the surgery. And so you're doing them a huge favor by telling them where they should go first and where they should maybe wait a while before they even attempt. I was thinking about what you were saying about the patients all want the robots, and it's almost like without any data. Tell me a little bit more about those interactions. So it sounds like patients are really coming into your office or your colleagues' offices and saying, I want the robot. And how do the surgeons respond to that? Do you even address it with the patients, or do you just say, yeah, we'll do the robot? I mean, tell me about that interaction, because that we've seen so much of like AI where people are like, no, keep it away from me. It's violating my privacy. I don't want AI. And yet in the case of the robots, it sounds like it might be a little bit different.
Yeah, I love that comparisons. I never talked about those two together, but you're exactly right. I mean, I think that there is this perception that the robot is more accurate. We don't address it. I mean, there's no reason to, right? I mean, I think that when laparoscopic surgery came into play, our patients would come and say they wanted laser surgery. And we were just confused in the beginning. We're like, what laser? There is no laser, but it was, I think, just maybe it started with an L and it just seemed futuristic. Right. We didn't know. And we're just like, okay, great. Yes, we'll do this laparoscopic surgery and you know, and then it would be fine. Like we, you know, what can you do?
You're just managing the communication.
You just manage it. I think when you step back from that, what is it? There is a high level of tech trust globally. It's mainstream.
Yeah.
Tech trust is really, really huge. And I think for me as a practitioner, when we get into tech trust within the health system, one example is the CT scan. That technology within my lifetime and my career has become more available, more efficient. I mean, it used to take 45 minutes to get a CT of a head 20 years ago. I mean, I remember we reserved that for specific groups of patients, but now you can get it in 5 minutes, you know, and so we use it more. What happened is that then we stopped doing physical exams and combining radiographs and exams in terms of getting to our diagnosis. And I think that's a huge mistake. Orthopedic surgeons are fighting it right now. You can't like keep sending all my patients to an MRI and you haven't done the functional exam.
So people are using it as a crutch.
They're using it as a crutch, but they also think that the MRI is going to tell me everything. And so the new physicians, we're fighting to maintain balance. Don't lose your skill. These skills are important. You know, it's the art and craft, the whole, you know, of medical diagnosis and treatment. And so we're fighting this tech trust thing, even within the physician training.
And your work strikes me as, now it gives me a new perspective on the work you've described, because even though it's very high tech, you know, you were saying sensors, video, motion tracking, but what you're studying is the human skill. And so as the robots start helping, you're going to have this incredible library that says, well, wait a minute, back in 2022, here, when it was all done by hand, by humans, here's the kinds of outcomes we had, A, and B, here's how we did it. And then you can give them stories about, well, during the hard parts, the really good surgeons slowed down and did some planning. And so it's, in a funny way, you're creating a historical registry of human experience that will be useful or not for the automated future. But if you didn't collect this data, it strikes me that we would have no idea if things are better or worse. So do you think of this as a historical project?
Russ, I do. I mean, the crazy part about it is, where have you been all my life? You did it. I mean, literally, I have been a surgeon with my head down pounding the pavement. So what mountaintop am I supposed to stand on to give this message? The irony in healthcare, we say the best way to hide all your information is to publish it in a high impact journal. Nobody reads those. I'm just saying, I'm being facetious here, but like the general public, industry, the academic machine has this little bit of a silo. And then there's the rest of the world and industry and mainstream. And so even being here with you, literally, this is the first time someone who's not a surgeon is like talking about it in a forum on a platform that's broad. But I don't have that marketing
right
in the lab right now.
It also raises the issue, if you are doing it, have you been doing this long enough that you can see changes in standard procedures where the way we did it 5 years ago has just evolved? And so the new best way to do, I don't know, an appendectomy or whatever has actually shifted a little bit? Because in other areas of data science, in the practice of medicine even, we notice that, you know, the way diabetes is treated definitely drifts over time. The way cancers are treated, of course. Are we seeing drift in surgical techniques?
Yes. Even physical exam, we focus on the irony, super specialization in healthcare. So you now, you know, certain physicians don't do certain physical exams anymore because they're super, you know, the urologist, they it's the prostate gland. So,
right.
You know, you have to palpate the rectum to get to the prostate gland. They're not doing a full exam of the rectum. It's the colorectal surgeons, right? So there is this, and sorry for that particular example on radio, but I mean, this is what we do.
Yes, of course, this is the real world.
But the super specialization has changed what it is that people do and focus on. Within surgery, it's usually new devices that change the whole workflow of an operation. If you think about doing one of the most difficult operations that we do, a pancreatical duodenectomy, the Whipple procedure, Russ, we were doing that procedure tying individual vessels off.
Right.
That procedure was a 10-hour procedure, 6 in the best hands, 20 years ago before we had cautery devices and stapling devices. Now that we have those devices, there are surgeons who can do that procedure in 2 hours.
Which is a huge improvement for patient outcomes, I'm sure.
Yes, less anesthesia, I mean, less bleeding, the whole 9 yards. So yes, we can track that difference in efficiency around that anatomy, and again, you know, track what it is that the masters who are doing it picked it up. And there's some surgeons transfer from one technology to the other more efficiently. We need to study that. We haven't had that opportunity yet over time, but I've interviewed and I've seen a lot of surgeons who went from, you know, the laparoscopic approach to the robotic approach, completely different ergonomics.
Well, thanks to Carla Pugh, that was the future of surgery. You have been listening to The Future of Everything with Russ Altman on SiriusXM Business Radio Channel 132.